the main theme of the lectures is going to be holographic entanglement entropy. But I'm drawing this diagram. It was sort of an entanglement entropy landscape that Horacio put up on Monday morning. And we see that it sort of fits into the middle of a number of different topics. And in fact, today I'm going to circle around in the middle of the landscape here before I get to holographic entanglement entropy. In part, I'm going to talk about this formula here just because I like it so much and because it's central to the discussion in the middle box here. But I'm also going to talk a little bit about entanglement entropy and quantum field theory just to set a language for my discussions later on when I get to this topic here. However, having sort of given you sort of schematically where we're going to go today, I wanted to start by or with an apology, because I my understanding is that this is a very diverse audience. And I know that there are a number of identifiable experts in the audience who know all about holographic entanglement entropy, and I really don't think I have much to offer you today, and so I apologize for that. The other half of the audience, these ideas that I'm going to be talking about may be perhaps challenging or at least very foreign to the kinds of things that you usually think about. And so if you find that I'm going too fast, don't hesitate to interrupt me and ask questions. And that includes you, Geekfit, okay? Very good. Okay, so this formula was a remarkable discovery made by these two gentlemen, Jacob Bekenstein and Stephen Hawking, in the early 1970s. Well, we may know that Stephen is still with us and going strong and going after the big questions. Unfortunately, Jacob just passed away last week. But they were both pioneers in their observations in the early 70s. And what they realized is that although at the time we thought of black holes as these, very elegant but static or frigid, if you like, objects, solutions of Einstein's equation, they realize that there's a much bigger story at play. And in fact, they showed, or what this formula tells us, is that black holes carry an entropy. And in fact, shortly afterwards, this actually was extended. And the key idea here is really just that horizons carry entropy. And so this same formula applies in cosmological situations, for example, De Sitter space, where there's a cosmological horizon, or in the Rindler wedge, where we talk about an observer horizon. But the key idea is that I've got an entropy on this side, and I'm relating it to the area of a cross-section of some interesting horizon in my space-time geometry. I've written it here with all of these constants. Usually, on HEPTH, we set all of these constants to 1, perhaps even Newton's constant here. But when I write it like this, we see that it provides us with a watering hole for many different areas of physics. And so in particular, with C cubed, the speed of light here, we have relativity. Over here, we've got Boltzmann's constant. And so we think of thermodynamics, statistical mechanics, or just generally thermal physics. Over here, we've got H-bar, so we've got quantum theory. Of course, it's a gravitational systems that we were thinking about, and so Newton's constant here reminds us of gravity. And so in this one formula, we're bringing together ideas from all of these different areas. And in particular, what we see here is quantum and gravity next to each other. And so it was long thought that this must be, or it's still thought, that this gives us a window into the properties of quantum gravity. One of the things that it does, or this formula as I've written it, does remind us is that when we combine the various, all of these different constants of nature, that provides us with a fundamental length scale. And so, in particular, we have the Planck scale, which I can think of as the, well, no. If I take the G, the H bar, not getting it, H bar C cubed, that defines a length scale squared. And one of the important things is that this length scale is really, really small. So it's about 10 to the minus 35 meters. And you might compare that, say, with 10 to the minus 20 meters, which is the minimum distance scales that we have accessible at the highest energy accelerators, namely the LHC right now. And so this is some 15 orders of magnitude smaller than that. And so it's a ways away from, experimentally physical access. But in particular, then, this formula says that what we're doing is essentially measuring the area of the horizon in units of the Planck scale. And so it reduces down to this picture here. But the thing is that if this is really, really small, that means that this is really, really big. And so one way to compare what I mean when I say really, really big is we can take a look at the sun. If we think of the sun as a big bag of hot gas, well, I can just write it over here. Then we can evaluate, or I can look at my notes and find that there's an entropy that I can associate with the sun in its current state, which is around 10 to the 58. And the Boltzmann's constant sits in there to get the units right. However, if I take the sun, which has a radius of some 700,000 kilometers, and I crush it down to a size of 3 kilometers, then I end up evaluating that formula. Well, the sun, all of that gas, disappears behind a horizon. I'm left with a black hole. But when I evaluate that formula, I find that, in fact, the entropy is shot up by some 20 orders of magnitude. And so, again, this is really, really small, but that means that these entropies that implicitly we're talking about are really, really big. This Boltzmann's constant is, again, one of these annoying constants that typically we would set to 1 when we're working on HepTH. But what it reminds us is that entropy was actually something that was invented by people who worried about work losses or heat losses, and they were interested in building better steam engines. But it reminds us of the stories of thermodynamics. And so originally, this entropy was introduced in a story of black hole thermodynamics. And Bekenstein, Hawking, and others in the day were thinking about processes, physical processes, where things fell into a black hole or interacted with a black hole. And they found that there was a certain amount of energy, in fact, that you can extract from a black hole, but there were other amounts of energy which you simply could not or would not be able to extract from a black hole. And so it was natural then to develop a story, a thermodynamic story, of these black hole interactions once this entropy made its appearance. Well, if you like, there's a phase transition when you hit the Schwarzschild radius, right? Because it can't be adiabatic after that point. It just, no matter what you do, all of that matter is just going to collapse down to a point, quote unquote. So if you like, it's a phase transition. Although you will have created a lot of entropy with the machine that you... But that's another. Thermodynamics. In ordinary thermodynamics, we also know that there's a statistical mechanical interpretation of entropy in terms of the von Neumann formula, something like trace low log rho. Formula we've seen many times already. And so this suggests if, as in ordinary thermodynamics, there's a statistical mechanical picture, then this formula is telling us about some set of microstates that underlie the black hole. And so now when we look at this formula, or when I look at this formula, one of the most striking things about it is that on this side of the formula, we've got some kind of information about microstates of quantum gravity or of the space-time. On the other hand, on this side of the formula, the key thing that's left over there is the geometry. So the space-time geometry encodes in some complicated way, information about the underlying microstates of quantum gravity. You're going to hear much more about this in Juan's colloquium this afternoon. But I did want to address one of the comments or rumors or murmurs that went around earlier in the week and at the dinner table last night, that this formula, or the black hole, or the horizon entropy, should be related to entanglement entropy. But to do that, I first have to sort of establish my language for the entanglement entropy in quantum field theory. And so I wanted to revisit that box just very quickly to sort of describe what Horacio described on Monday morning, but in a slightly different language. Do those really work? Okay. I'll go there in a second. What do we want? Okay, so entanglement generally is something, when we say that, it's one of the key ideas that distinguishes the quantum world or quantum physics from classical physics. And typically when we talk about entanglement, we start to think by thinking about an EPR pair or the EPR paradox, where we have these photons shooting off in opposite directions, and yet the measurements over here that Alice makes affects the outcome of measurements that Bob makes far away. And if I'm talking about a system like that where I only have a few moving parts, i.e. two photons, two spins, or some fixed number of spins, it's relatively easy to decide whether the state that I'm talking about, the quantum state that describes those different moving parts, is entangled or it's not entangled. And in fact, quantum information theorists have a number of different diagnostics that you can apply and see entanglement or the absence of entanglement in various simple systems like that. But what one needs when we're talking about quantum field theory, where we've now got a system with many different degrees of freedom or many moving parts, is some general diagnostic. And so that's what entanglement entropy is. It's a general diagnostic by which we're going to detect and measure the degree of entanglement between different parts of a system. In general, what we're just doing is we're dividing the system into two parts, our favorite system, and using entropy as a measure of the correlations between the two subsystems. When I apply it to quantum field theory, what that recipe means is the following. So first, what I'm going to do is I'm going to pick a Cauchy slice. Or a constant time slice. So I will get to that board soon. So here's my constant time slice. I can take the field configurations on that time slice as characterizing the space of states that we're interested in. Implicitly, typically, I'm going to be thinking about the vacuum or some simple state, perhaps a thermal state. But most of what I'm saying could apply quite generally. And so what we want to do, what I said we want to do, is we want to divide that system into two. So here's my Cauchy surface. I'm just going to introduce some boundary, or what I'll call an entangling surface, that distinguishes then an inside and an outside. Usually, again, that's a smooth surface. It may have corners or singularities in it, and it may have many different components, but the key idea is it's dividing our Cauchy surface into two pieces. So we introduce a boundary or an entangling surface. I introduce this nomenclature entangling surface just because the lecture is about holographic entanglement entropy. As we'll see, the word boundary is a word that's taken or used. And so saying entangling surface is just supposed to minimize the overlap or minimize the confusion. So now we have our two regions. What I'm going to do is I'm going to integrate out the degrees of freedom in the outside region B. What that means then is what's left over, the stuff in A, is going to be described by some density matrix. So we have a reduced density, or we've reduced the state onto A, and we have the reduced density matrix. And then we just apply our von Neumann formula. And in this particular case, that's what we call, or what we will call, the entanglement entropy. I'm not sure if it's needed for this audience, but in some audiences, I have to say that my logarithm is a natural log, so that's base e, not base 2. So there's some distinction if you come from a quantum information background. Now, the thing is that if I assign this as a homework problem or one of the problems this afternoon, even before you've started, I know what the answer is going to be. The answer is going to be infinity. And the problem is that the answer, this entropy, is going to be dominated by short wavelength degrees of freedom in the vicinity of my entangling surface. So in the quantum field theory, there are degrees of freedom to arbitrarily short wavelengths, and that produces, well, that contributes an infinite amount of correlation or entanglement between the two regions. And so to make sense of this calculation, I'm going to have to introduce a regulator, or I'm going to have to cut off or eliminate these short wavelength contributions. And so the way I'd like to do that or discuss it today is I'm going to introduce some short distance cutoff that I'll call delta. And so we're just going to ignore wavelengths less than the distance delta. In Adasio's calculations, he introduced a lattice, and so delta is naturally associated with the lattice spacing. So this was dominated by short wavelengths, and we regulate with delta being some short distance regulator. And so if R is some macroscopic scale here that characterizes the geometry of my entangling surface, and D is the space-time dimension, then, so we live in four space-time dimensions, 3 plus 1. We may also talk about 3 dimensions, 2 dimensions. Being a string theorist, I can talk about higher dimensions as well. But if we've regulated in this way, then the answer here, turns out, is given by powers of the ratio of the macroscopic scale over delta to powers controlled by the space-time dimension. So is some coefficient times R over delta to the D minus 2 like that. And in fact, if I do this calculation for not just one entangling surface, but for many different entangling surfaces, what I'll find is that the numerators here, these powers of R, actually have a more geometric interpretation in terms of the geometry of my entangling surface, sigma. So in particular, the first term is the area . So I use area in the sense that if I was working in four space-time dimensions, that's a quantity that is length squared. In higher dimensions, it's the volume of a codimension 2 surface. Or in lower dimensions, it's, well, the same. And if I think about, so this is some new coefficient. If I think about these terms, what I'll find is that there's an integral over the entangling surface, but now there'll be some kind of curvature in my integral. And the details of that depend on the theory that I'm working with. Yep. It should. It should be D minus 4. How about that? Okay, sorry about that. Yeah, it went down by a power of 2, and so a curvature naturally makes up that extra dimension. That's why it went by 2 rather than 1. However, I should say that this structure that I'm talking about here made an assumption, which is an obvious assumption or an obvious, it's second nature if I'm working on HepTH, but I'm thinking that I'm working with a regulator. That is Lorentz invariant or covariant. And so if I'm working with a lattice, then I have to work harder, or I have to think harder about the details of what this is giving me. However, yeah. Yep. Yep. So I haven't actually connected this to that, but I'm about to do so. So you have to be a little bit patient. So one of the issues, though, that Orazio pointed out or mentioned was that these coefficients here are not universal, or they depend on the details of the regulator that I chose. So if I did the calculation and my grad student did the calculation with some different regulator, then we'd get different numbers for C0 and C2, et cetera. So this is some elegant information about the geometry, but this is information not just about the quantum field theory, but also about the regulator that we chose to make sense of this calculation. On the other hand, if I persist in calculating to higher and higher orders, we can find universal information in this formula. So for example here, we may find eventually that there's a term that goes as the logarithm. And in that particular case, this coefficient is universal, by which I mean it's not going to be sensitive to the details of the regulator. And in particular, then, this is a number that gives me information that allows me to characterize the quantum field theory that's underlying this particular calculation. So that depends only on the details of the properties of the quantum field theory and not the regulator. However, I covered my watch. Wow. I'm going till 10:30. The key idea here is that I see an area here, and so the entanglement entropy . So the leading contribution or the dominant contribution in that formula is proportional to the area. So that contrasts with the typical entropies, by which I mean thermal entropies, where you have an extensive quantity that's proportional to the volume. But this unusual behavior is precisely the behavior that we were seeing here for the black hole entropy. So this is And so that's really at the heart, or what's this is known as the area law, but that's really what's at the heart of this idea that entanglement entropy and black hole entropy or horizon entropy might be connected. And so it was really Raphael Sorkin here who in 84 suggested this connection. But I really have to say that Raphael was really another pioneer or a pathfinder in that he was doing this at a time when people didn't put the words entanglement and entropy together. There was a sense of the idea of entanglement. He did a set of calculations that we now understand are essentially the set of calculations that I described, and he discovered this area law. And that's what led him to make this suggestion. But in this case, then the it's natural to think that the horizon, which divides the inside from the outside, is a natural candidate for the entangling surface or an entangling surface. And his original suggestion was that perhaps we should think that these two are equal, but then quantum gravity must naturally or provide a regulator with this cutoff here being of the order of the Planck scale. So this was a calculation in general, d dimensions. This power here is for a four-dimensional space-time. If I think about black holes in arbitrary space-times, this scale, well, this is, again, the area of a codimension 2 surface, and this power, or this power here, is naturally d minus 2, just as it is in that formula there. Now, this was a very interesting idea, and like many interesting ideas, the reaction of the community was to ignore it. And it was only some, what do I have here? I think it was 93. So it's several years later that this idea was rediscovered. And actually, in the 1990s, this became an active topic of research, trying to make sense of this idea that these two quantities should be related. But there are, the truth is there were recognized at that time a number of different issues, and in fact there are a number of outstanding issues. But let me address one of them, which was this regulator dependence of the coefficient. The Bekenstein-Hawking formula gives us a finite answer, but it's a finite answer that has a very universal coefficient, this 1 over 4 times some power of the Planck scale, or 1 over 4g, if we use stand or our favorite units over there. Whereas this C naught is something that's supposed to depend on the details of the choice of regulator that I'm choosing to regulate things. So this is a quantum gravity problem. It might be that quantum gravity somehow resolves this ambiguity. And ultimately, if this is true, it must be that there's some natural way that it cuts it off in a universal or regulates the entanglement entropy in a universal way. But this field theory calculation, it was recognized by Lenny Susskind and John Uglum in this period, that we can understand that when we're doing the field theory calculations, we're calculating a contribution towards the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, but we're not calculating the full entropy. And their idea is that if I have my quantum fields and they are coupled to a graviton or to gravity weakly, then the loops of the quantum fields are going to renormalize Newton's constant. And so in particular, if I think about a graviton propagator, I would find that there are divergences in that calculation, power law divergences, that match, well, the dimension of Newton's constant. And so I would find a power law divergence that matches the divergence that I find in the entanglement entropy. So the idea is, well, and this power law divergence, the precise coefficients that you find are going to depend on the details of the regulator. And so the idea is if I choose a fixed regulator, then I'll find that there's some particular coefficient that appears in the renormalization or in this when I regulate Newton's constant or the propagator. But that precisely should match the coefficient for an entanglement entropy calculation where I'm using the black hole horizon or some horizon. And so the idea is then that the entanglement entropy of the quantum field is a contribution to the black hole, but that these calculations that we've been doing or that people started to do should not be interpreted as the full Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. Of course, that leaves us, or it leaves many people, including some of the folks at dinner last night, very unsatisfied in that the idea, there's this nice idea that there's some kind of entanglement entropy that match, or that this is some kind of entanglement entropy, but we really don't have a picture of or a framework where we can think about the microstates of the quantum gravity theory or the degrees of freedom of our quantum gravity theory, or we haven't yet successfully done that. And so we really don't understand if this is a correction to the full answer, where was the bare term coming from? What there's a bare Newton's constant that's giving us a contribution like this, and what was that entropy coming from? So that's the main stumbling block at this point. And it's simply not, it's an open problem. There's a room full of students, so there's a problem to try and close the loop here, to try and understand, is there a framework where we can understand the bare contribution here in terms of some microscopic states in our quantum gravity theory? Call you. Well, it's I mean, it's no. What do you see? I mean, it becomes a target for your theory of quantum gravity, right? I mean, black hole entropy for 20, 30 years now has been a target. And so in string theory, we're very happy that we can do calculations for certain extremal black holes as a counting of the number of states. In the same way, some of our friends using discrete models of quantum gravity have their own calculations where they claim that they understand this. But I think it's fair to say that we don't really have a fully consistent or a complete understanding of this idea. And it could be that the idea is wrong. It still stands as a conjecture, but it just seems such a compelling idea. It passes a number of hurdles, but it's also fair to say that it's not a complete idea. There are a number of stumbling blocks and things. I mean, even technical issues where it seems not quite to work out the way you would like it to work out. Yeah. But you've also lost the power law divergences in these calculations here, so you've made it more mysterious. I agree. It doesn't lend much progress. It's a nice way to regulate things, but I don't think I don't think choosing that particular regulator lends much insight to this idea or this problem. As I said, it's an idea. I find it a compelling idea. Many people do. There are others who remain unconvinced. But I thought okay. It's a school. I thought I'd throw that out there, and I will move ahead. I should. Are there other questions? Is what? So the idea here is that I've done a calculation. For instance, in the propagator, I would have a bare propagator with a bare Newton's constant as the coefficient. So something I might call 1 over G naught. And then I might add to that, say, a one-loop calculation where there's some, I don't know, pick your favorite field, a scalar field propagating in a loop. So the graviton couples to the stress tensor of my scalar. It runs in a loop and couples there. And so that's a contribution. This is going to give me a similar power law divergence. And that's what I'm calling this delta 1 over G. And so this represents it's in that sense that I'm saying there's a contribution to the full propagator or to the full Newton's constant. In the same way, I do an entanglement entropy calculation, and what I find is something that, this is a calculation just of a scalar field in some fixed geometry with, maybe a black hole geometry where the horizon is just a fixed surface. And what I'm finding is that there's a contribution, the area law contribution, that has the same coefficient times the area of the horizon over 4. And so if this is supposed to be incorporated into the Bekenstein-Hawking formula, it's only a part of the answer. It's only got this shift in the Newton's constant. And the question is, but to really turn it into the Bekenstein-Hawking formula, there had to be a term, a bare term, that I added to that, which was one over four G naught, this one that appeared in my initial Lagrangian. And so to make sense of that formula, well, I understand that this contribution is an entanglement entropy, and I can see the quantum field modes, et cetera, et cetera. But I really don't have a clear grasp of why this should be an entanglement entropy. Somehow the microscopic theory, well, if it is an entanglement entropy, and it may not be, this is a conjecture, but somehow the microscopic states of the quantum gravity, the things that make up the space-time that the field is propagating in, are giving us that contribution there, or should be giving us that contribution there. Yeah. Again, there was an assumption here that I've got some kind of nice regulator or a covariant regulator. And the basic idea is because all of these coefficients or all of the numerators have some kind of geometric interpretation. And so what I'm integrating here, I mean, there's nothing with a single derivative, or there's no single power curvature that I can integrate over the surface, and so there's no term here. When I write a curvature, that's something with two derivatives in it, and so it makes up two powers of length, and that's why it dropped down by two powers. Was that clear, or? Yeah, okay. And since we're over there, I might add that you can also identify these contributions with similar renormalizations or contributions to higher curvature terms in an effective gravity action. So as well as the leading Einstein term that gives you Newton's constant, there might be curvature squared, curvature cubed, a whole series expansion in powers of curvature. Through something known as the Wald entropy, we know that those will also contribute to the horizon entropy. And so you can see this particular contribution as coming from a renormalization of the corresponding coefficient in the effective action. Okay, I should keep moving. So that was it. Well, okay, that gave me an opportunity to say a lot of things, but that was an idea I wanted to throw out there. What we really want to talk about is holographic entanglement entropy. And so what I really mean there is, I'll just say some words. So holography, by holography here, I mean in the context of quantum gravity or in gravitational theory. So far here, I just focused on the idea that there's an entropy that I can associate with horizons or black holes, but it's, of course, part of a much bigger story. We also know that there's a temperature that's associated with the horizon. And so Stephen Hawking, was really only that this coefficient was fixed after Hawking realized that there's a certain particular temperature that I can associate with a horizon. And that leads then to a story about the black holes evaporating, the information paradox, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's something that I hope we're going to hear a lot about at the colloquium this afternoon, some new ideas about that. But holography then is basically in that context the idea that what I said was that the horizon was encoding some kind of information about the microstates, but holography in some sense is saying that the horizon's description of those microstates extends beyond just some kind of counting like this, but extends to the dynamics, i.e. that the whole evolution of the black hole, its interactions with the outside world, can be described in terms of some kind of effective theory that lives on this surface in space-time. And so it's something that's capturing, another slogan that it captures is the idea that in quantum gravity, at short distances, there should be fewer degrees of freedom than in an ordinary quantum field theory. And this was an idea that was pioneered, again, by Leni Susskind, but before him, Gerard Atuft. And that, again, takes us back to the early 90s. And as with most, well, it's another one of these good ideas that kind of sat around and people poked at it, but we didn't really pay much attention until 1997. And things really took off then with the advent of the ADS-CFT correspondence. And so this is clearly a topic that's worth an entire course by itself. And so for the people for whom this is a new idea, feel free to ask me lots of questions afterwards, but right now in the lecture, I can only give you a few pointers, some of the salient ideas that are going to be important when we talk about entanglement entropy in this context. So what is the ADS-CFT correspondence? It's really a dictionary that translates between two different languages. So what are those languages? Well, ADS over here, what we have is anti-de Sitter space. So the ADS is the anti-de Sitter. On the other side of the dictionary, we have conformal field theory. So the CFT of the correspondence. Now over here, the language is a language of quantum field theory. Of course, the conformal indicates it's not just any old quantum field theory, but a quantum field theory without any intrinsic scales. And this is a theory that lives, in my notation, in D space-time dimensions. On the other side, what's the language? Well, in principle, this is the language of quantum gravity. The anti-de Sitter, as I'll describe in a moment, indicates that there's some kind of negative cosmological constant. And then this is a theory that lives in D plus 1. Space-time dimensions. And so here we have our holography. The dictionary is relating one description of physical phenomena in a D-dimensional space-time to another description of the same phenomena with one extra space-time dimension, or usually one extra spatial dimension. So if this is the first time that you're seeing this, this should sound absurd. In particular, there's a theory, there are theories in different space-time dimensions, and I'm saying that they are actually describing the same thing. Over here, I've got gravity, and a salient point is that over here, there's no gravity. So again, this seems to be a real conflict. And so for today, all I'm going to say is that this is a it was originally proposed by Juan in 1997 as a conjecture, but it's a conjecture that's survived the scrutiny of literally thousands of man hours and research projects. A large part of that is extending the dictionary, trying to find the different entries and how they match up between the two sides. Caveat, though, is that I said that this is a theory of quantum gravity, which sounds very intimidating. In fact, most of the calculations, and certainly all of the calculations that I'll do, our calculations in the context of classical gravity with small curvatures. And what that's going to do is it's going to push us into a particular regime or a particular parameter space on the other side of the dictionary. And so over here, we're going to be talking about conformal field theories with large numbers of degrees of freedom, or alternatively, sometimes we say there's a large central charge, or we might say that the number, well, often this is a gauge theory, and so we say the rank of the gauge group tends to infinity. The other caveat over here is that we're going to be in a strong coupling regime. Of course, the beauty of the duality is that this, well, these field theories may be field theories of interest, but they're field theories for which standard calculations are difficult. And so here we're getting a window on those particular theories through simpler gravitational calculations on this side. And we'll see in a moment that holographic entanglement entropy is one example of that. But before I get there, my assumption is that this side of the board or the dictionary is more familiar than this side, so I wanted to say a few more words about this anti-de Sitter space. So one description of anti-de Sitter space is it's the maximally symmetric geometry with negative curvature. More precisely, I might write down a metric on this geometry. So this is a tool that tells us about distances between nearby points. And so there's a part of it in my metric that may look familiar. This looks like the metric on Minkowski space. Then there's a prefactor. And then there's that involves this coordinate r. And then there's an extra bit there for the r. So diagrammatically, if I want to draw a cartoon of that space, in that metric, I said there's this part that looks like flat space. So these are the X's and the T's running in those, in my picture, what I'll call horizontal directions. But then there's this scaling as I go or move around in R, that picture or those distances get scaled. And so I might draw a picture. Diagram R is running up, so it's getting bigger as I go up the board. And so the coefficient here is getting larger, and so my x and t directions are expanding in that particular description or in that cartoon. Another thing we might say here is that it's the simplest solution of the Einstein equations. negative cosmological constant. And so what I mean is I'm solving this particular equation. So this is something about the geometry. That's some kind of curvature. These are the components of my metric. And then there's this coefficient here that carries this number L squared. So that's the same coefficient, that same L here. And so that's the curvature scale of the ADS geometry. In my dictionary, I had these two different languages. In particular, there was this CFT that lived in D space-time dimensions. And so there, the CFT degrees of freedom are running around in the T and the X directions. And so that's a D-dimensional space-time. So the boundary, so if I think of this as R equals infinity, again, this is just a cartoon. My boundary here is D dimensions. And it's the home of the CFT, or the conformal field theory. The bulk then has an extra r direction. So here I have d plus 1 dimensions. And I guess I'm introducing these as, well, these buzzwords appear over and over. Boundary is the boundary of the ADS. Bulk means the interior of the ADS. And this is the home of the gravity theory, or the quantum gravity theory. And as I was describing, if I have a displacement, say, of 1 centimeter in the x direction, then the true distance, as measured by this metric, gets scaled by this factor. And so out here, I might draw a 1 centimeter displacement, delta x. But at r equals infinity, that's actually an infinite distance. In general, it's very, very large, and it's becoming smaller and smaller as I shrink down through smaller and smaller r. And so I might refer to that as a redshift in that, for small r's, things are getting these distance scales are getting smaller. One of the interesting entries here in this dictionary is the relation between a black hole and a thermal ensemble in the CFT language. And so in particular, on this side, I talked briefly, or I mentioned the idea that there's a temperature, the Hawking temperature, that's associated with the horizon of the black hole. Well, I should say that in this case, for a black hole, this geometry gets modified, and there's some kind of horizon then that cuts the geometry off. At some particular radius. And so, well, again, this is a cartoon. The geometry gets modified in more interesting ways than I'm making out there. But the temperature here is related to the radius. And I needed, to get the units right, I needed a conversion constant. And the ADS curvature scale presents us with that constant. And on the other side, then, the Hawking temperature in the gravity theory, or for the black hole, becomes the temperature of the thermal state on the other side of the dictionary. In particular, then, the horizon entropy, or this Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, which is just, I'll write it as A over 4G, becomes the thermal entropy, my apologies, on the other side of the dictionary. And what you'll find there is that roughly it goes like the volume of our system, which is now d-dimensional, that's one dimension less, times this temperature to the d minus 1. So if we had time, I could write out in detail what this formula is, and then using this formula here, we could translate it. And so there's some overall coefficient, but we see on the CFT side, we get an extensive entropy, and it's proportional to the temperature to the appropriate power, where this is the only scale in the problem because this is a CFT, and so that had to work out to match the powers of the volume here. I'm not sure. It depends. Can I, just because I'm going to run out of time, can you ask me later? Because I have to write down, I have to get to the next page so that they can work on problems this afternoon if they want. What was the other thing? Another interesting feature over here, or just of the dictionary in general, is there's this idea of an extra space-time dimension. You might ask, why do I need an extra space-time dimension? And the idea is that this is a conformal field theory, and so, or a rough idea, a rough intuition might be that this is a conformal field theory, and so if I find or identify a certain set of excitations, I'll find a similar set of excitations at all different scales, at all different energy scales. And what the geometry on this side is doing is organizing those excitations in energy scales by the radius. And so roughly there's a relationship between the energy and the radius. And so one of the ways you can see that is with this dictionary here, a larger temperature or larger defines a larger energy, and we can see that as I go to larger temperatures, I'm pushing the horizon further and further out into the geometry. And so we see then that moving this up correspondingly takes us to higher energies. More generally, we would say that if I'm probing the geometry at very large radius, what I'm doing is I'm probing the high energy excitations or degrees of freedom of the CFT. If I'm probing it at small radius, I'm probing the low energy excitations of the CFT. And at that point, I should pause and ask if there are any questions from the non-experts. Because then a miracle is going to happen, and we're going to talk about entanglement entropy for 30 seconds. OK. So I want to get back to the idea of entanglement entropy or holographic entanglement entropy. I'm just going to introduce the idea, or the key concept, and I guess I'm going to talk about it more on Saturday. So how can we relate this picture to the discussion that we had before, or the discussion I gave before about entanglement entropy in quantum field theory? Well, certainly this is a story about a particular quantum field theory, namely the boundary CFT here. And so I can draw that picture that we drew, or I drew before, about a Cauchy slice and dividing that up into two regions. But I would draw that picture out here on the boundary of my ADS space. So if I think of these directions that I've drawn as being x directions or representing this part, and I've suppressed time or I've chosen a particular time slice in this picture, then I would just draw my entangling surface. I'd have an A and a B, and I could talk about, in the conformal field theory, I want to integrate out the degrees of freedom in B. I'm given a density matrix in A. We calculate the von Neumann entropy or the entanglement entropy. That's clearly going to be, well, you may already have the idea that in quantum field theory, those are very difficult calculations. Here we have a strongly coupled CFT. It's going to be difficult squared. And so what we'd really like to do is we'd like to take advantage of this dictionary to convert this difficult quantum field theory calculation into a simple geometric or gravitational calculation. So we want to translate a calculation of entanglement entropy in the CFT to a geometric calculation in the ADS space. And that's what Ru and Takinagi proposed in 2006. And their proposal is that the entanglement entropy of that region A is going to be given by evaluating A over 4G, or the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, on all surfaces which match up, the boundary of the bulk surface should match up to the entangling surface, and then I choose the surface that gives me the minimal area, and that would that the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of that particular extremal surface or minimal area surface will match, give us the entanglement entropy. So I'm thinking I've got a particular geometry. I'm thinking about all particular or any particular surface V that'll hang down into the bulk. And why would it hang down? Well, it's this story about the redshift. To get from here to here out at large radius costs us a lot of area, but by dipping down here to get from here to here costs us a small amount of area. And so that's why these surfaces tend to hang down into the bulk of the geometry. But the one that gives us the minimum area then yields the entanglement entropy. At this point, I'm going to look at Shota and ask him. Six minutes. Excellent. Okay. So they hang down because of the redshift. There's an immediate problem, though, with this idea as I presented it, which is that I told you to evaluate the area of a surface that runs from down here in the bulk somewhere all the way out to R equals infinity, or the boundary of the ADS. And so, again, well, what I know is I'm going to get a divergent answer if I try and evaluate that particular area. But in fact, that's not really a problem. Rather, it's a feature. Because I told you back earlier in the lecture that I should expect that the entanglement entropy in my quantum field theory is actually an infinite or give that the calculation will give me an infinite result unless I take the time to regulate that. I also said that it's dominated by short wavelength or high energy excitations, and that's exactly where the divergence is coming from. It's coming from the area contributions out here at large radius, but that's the part of the geometry that describes these high energy excitations. So what do? Well, we regulate. In particular, we'd like to introduce this short distance cutoff. I said that short distances or short wavelength excitations or high energy excitations correspond to large R, and so our cutoff here should be proportional to the inverse of some large radius in my ADS geometry. Again, to get the units right, I need some conversion constant, but the ADS scale provides us precisely with that. And so what I do then is I introduce some cutoff surface here. That cuts off the area of V by only integrating out to this capital R naught or to some very large radius that's fixed by the short distance cutoff in the CFT. There are also other details for this formula. One is that I wrote minimal area surface here. When you look at the problem set, you'll actually see that this formula has extreme, or it's the extremal area. What we're really looking for is a saddle point. The reason I'm saying extremal is that if I'm working in a Lorentzian metric, I can always make the area smaller by shifting it up into the time direction. But what we really want, or what Ryu and Takinagi are telling us, is to really look for the saddle point or the extremum in that particular situation. If I had a Euclidean signature, then that wouldn't be a problem. The other difference in the formula is I write something like V is homologous or wiggle to this region A. Oh, I guess that's bad notation. Let's put some curls on that to denote area. But this idea of homology just means that, it's explained in the problem set. In some sense, it means that if I take the region A union with my my bulk surface, that they connect up and form some closed surface that should be, you can shrink it to a point, if you like, in the bulk geometry. And part of the problem set is to explain exactly why that homology constraint plays an interesting role, why it's not just this particular definition where you're hooking up the boundary of your bulk surface to the entangling surface on the boundary. So I think at that point I should quit, or rather ask for questions. Okay. Or what? Is what? Is this? Yes. This comes back to the idea of a saddle point. This is a space-like region in the geometry, and the saddle points are all sort of outside the light cone, you find space-like surfaces, so you get a positive area.